May it please the court. The prerequisites for in pari delicto are not present in this case. And so, in fact, it becomes a very, very easy case, I think, without having to get into the intricacies of New York law. The wrong that PwC is being accused of is vastly different than the wrong that any other defendants are being accused of. In pari delicto requires defendants to be working together to commit a joint wrong. And in fact, if you look at PwC's brief, they say things like, quote, like or equal fault from Iroquois Gas, or they say things like they suffered because of the joint wrongdoing, or courts should not mediate disputes, quote, between wrongdoers engaged in illegal conduct. That's all on page 14 of their brief, and I agree with them on that part of that. Because the whole idea of pari delicto is that not to have the court being involved in dividing up the booty among the perpetrators of the crime. Here we're talking about something completely different. We're talking about wrongdoing on behalf of lots of folks who committed these wrongs that caused the financial statements to be misstated. And then we're talking about something that happens at an entirely different time and place when PwC comes in and audits them. They blew the audit. Nobody caused them to blow the audit. It wasn't a conspiracy to blow the audit. They just blew the audit. And so I think it becomes a very, very easy decision. You know, all Latin aside and whether, you know, we use the right term or not that they complain about, it's just the basis of in pari delicto is not a situation where you have someone else coming in later on after the bad acts were committed and says, I'm supposed to audit them. That can't possibly be what pari delicto was all about. So I think the court can decide it on that very easy issue.
Well, wait a second. Under what law?
I think that doesn't matter. I mean, even under New York law, it doesn't matter. And the cases that I'm referring to, Iroquois Gas, and the cases that they cite on page 14 of their brief, that's true everywhere. New York?
I thought that there were some cases in New York that dealt with outside auditors, which would seem to be exactly the situation we have here, and they said no dice.
I don't think they do, and I don't think those are the New York cases in this kind of situation. In fact, I think we make clear in our brief that the precise situation in front of the court has actually never been before the New York Court of Appeals, or I believe, for that matter, the Appellate Division. But that actually leads into my second point, which is New York law, to the extent that there is any, is now in major question. And that was the case that I sent to the court, which was some supplemental authority because it came out after our briefs were in, the case of Kirshner versus KPMG.
Now, I understand that since you wrote to this court, that certified question's been accepted. Is that correct?
If that happened, it's recent, and I guess we should have been on top of that, but I don't know for certain.
That's our understanding.
That's probably true. Was it in the last week and I missed it?
No, it was actually January 19th.
Okay. Mea culpa on that one. I should have been on top of that.
Right. Well, now that we know that, there's not a complete overlap, and there may not be any overlap. You've asked us to certify the question in this case as an alternative argument. But since that question has been accepted, will a decision in that case affect the case we have on appeal here?
Likely. Obviously, I can't say with certainty. I don't know how they're going to answer the questions and what they're going to do. And it's actually very kind of interesting.
At the end of the certification, they say if you don't answer everything, at least answer these two.
Right. And that's number two and three. And I'm glad Your Honor was focused on that because I think very much that will affect us because question two is whether the adverse interest exception is satisfied by showing that the insiders intended to benefit themselves by their misconduct. In other words, not that it was exclusive, but as long as they intended themselves to benefit, which clearly is true here, that would qualify as the adverse interest exception. So I think that, you know, the answer to that, depending on how it's answered, could, you know, have a major effect on this case.
But I think Justice Berger's question implicates another part of the doctrine, which really is if the claim is that this particular wrongdoer was negligent, are they within the doctrine or not? And there seem to be some cases in the brief that suggest negligence brings you within. You take the position that if the you're like here, Price Waterhouse conduct was negligent, doesn't apply at all.
I think that's correct. And I think, interestingly enough, the Second Circuit, agrees with me, because if the Second Circuit agreed with PwC, they would have just affirmed the court below in the Refco case, in that Kirshner case, which I referred to as Refco. But instead, what they had there was they had a bankruptcy trustee coming in and looking at a situation with an auditor and the company that committed the wrongdoing and was bankrupt. And if Wagner and those and was really the and its progeny were really the state of the law in a situation like ours, then it was very easy for them to say affirmed. In fact, Judge Lynch, when he ruled on it, based it on Wagner and said, that's what it is. But the Second Circuit was very uncomfortable with that. And, they really had two alternatives. They could have said, no, that's not what Wagner meant, or it's not applicable here, and written a decision. I think they did what was probably the easier thing, which was to turn around and say, we're going to send it to the New York State Court of Appeals. This issue has been percolating around. It's never been decided. This is the court that ought to be deciding it. And so they sent it to him, which, makes sense. But it seems to me that really there are three choices for this court. One, as I suggested, is simply saying the prerequisites aren't there because it's not equal fault, and saying so under New York law or anyone else's law, it doesn't work. The second thing to do is to try to predict what the New York Court of Appeals would do. And that's obviously difficult. And I think writing on a clean slate, this court, if it wanted to, could do what the vice chancellor did. And, in that 4 or 5 page single space footnote, gave a very thorough analysis of, if you're a court of last resort trying to decide what the law of the state ought to be, here's the analysis that you ought to use. And so this court could help assist a court along and say, this is how I predict the New York State Court of Appeals would do it, because I think it's quite rational, and basically write an opinion similar to the vice chancellor's footnote. The last alternative, which I guess may be the easiest because it's modeled after the Second Circuit, is to say, I'm going to wait and see what the New York State Court of Appeal does. And you can do that either in a passive way or in an active way. The passive way is just to wait and see what the court does in response to the 8 questions that were asked. And actually what I really liked about it was, and by the way, if there's anything else you'd like to say on the subject, please feel free to do so. So we don't know what we're going to get from the New York State Court of Appeals, but clearly it would be worth waiting. The other alternative is to say, as long as you're answering those questions, we'd like to ask you a few specific ones also, and I would suggest the ones that we did question presented in our appellate brief here would be the ones that one would certify there. So you could say, look, as long as you're deciding the issue, can we throw a few more questions at you? And they could say yes or they could say no.
Yeah, but even if we don't pile on additional questions, your position is that if the questions that were certified by the Second Circuit were answered, or at least the major ones, that would likely affect the outcome of this
likely
appeal.
I think if you ask the specific questions that we pose here and they said, yes, we'll take those on also, as long as we're covering the whole subject, we might as well do it for everyone, then I think it would be even more likely. But since I don't know what the answers are, I hate to say it absolutely will do so and then show up here a year from now after they've answered it and say, I don't think that really addresses our questions. So I think there's an advantage to sending our questions over there and saying, as long as you're covering the subject, would you mind taking a look at this also? The worst thing they can say is no.
How do you respond to the other side's argument that, while this court has statutory and rule authority to decide certified questions on the import side, we can't export certified questions because there's no statute that explicitly authorizes it?
I'm not sure one needs a statute to explicitly authorize it. I believe that the court has the inherent power to ask another sister court for to answer questions, as long as that sister court has a process by which one can do that. And they do have a process we put forward to the court. I think the Vice Chancellor also pointed out. And, you know, especially where the New York State Court of Appeals specifically says it can answer questions from other courts, it doesn't seem to offend at all Delaware jurisprudence. And I would add to that that this court would still be deciding this case. You ask the questions are answered, and then it is still your authority to decide this case based on the information that you've been given. So that's why I don't think there's any issue at all, because you never give up your authority.
You mean we're not giving up jurisdiction?
Correct. Unless you have any specific questions, I'll save the rest of my time for rebuttal.
Thank you.
Good afternoon. May it please the Court. Tom Rafferty on behalf of PricewaterhouseCoopers. I'd like to start with this notion that the Revco certified questions will in any way impact the issues here. The Revco questions are all related to what is a difficult area in New York law, the adverse interest exception. And that, unfortunately for the appellant here, is not an argument that was preserved from the decision below. And we were very careful in our responsive brief to point out that derivative plaintiffs do not argue that the adverse interest exception applies here. And the appellant didn't dispute that in its reply. What it said instead was, well, there are two other exceptions, this so-called participants criminis and the tree plateau exceptions, that do apply, but they never argued that the adverse interest exception was the subject matter of this appeal. So whatever the New York Court of Appeals decides on the specifics of the adverse interest doctrine in response to those questions, it will have absolutely no impact on the decision here, because it's simply not an issue in this case. I would also like to say that Revco itself, the Kirshner decision, which certified the questions to the New York Court of Appeals, while certifying those questions, the court went out of its way to be clear about several topics, including the fact that in pari delicto is a viable defense under New York law, where the adverse interest exception is not in place, to an auditor, to an outside auditor of a company. The question in Revco was whether there was any benefit to Revco, and it was more complicated than this instance in that Revco had all of these separate entities.
But now when they reached that conclusion, and they didn't cite anything from the highest court in New York, that was their collective view of where the law stands without a definitive pronouncement. Isn't that correct?
Well, there is no definitive pronouncement from the highest court of New York in which the case is so specific that it's an outside auditor and the company bringing the claim, nor is there a specific case in which it's a derivative lawsuit against the outside auditor. But the Trainer v. John Hancock case, which is a New York impari delicto case from the Court of Appeals, makes very clear that impari delicto is a viable doctrine in New York. It also makes a number of other things clear. It makes clear that an agent, and part of the appellant's argument here is that they shouldn't be charged with the conduct and knowledge of the AIG insiders who actually ran the company. But in the Trainer case, an agent for John Hancock went and arranged to exchange some existing policies for a new policy and violated the insurance regulations. The insured, on the other hand, made an affirmative misstatement about the condition of his health. He had cirrhosis of the liver, he had been hospitalized, and so the issue was, could his estate recover on the claim on the insurance? And impari delicto was held to bar that.
I know that, and I know all of these courts were not, you know, the highest court in New York. And my question really relates to what this court should do in light of the certification. It seems that, you know, if the New York Court of Appeals decides that the impari delicto doctrine doesn't apply at all, they never have to answer the question on the exception. If they get to the exception, then along the way, when they review all of the jurisprudence in this area by the lower courts, they may acknowledge, accept, comment favorably or disfavorably on something that will be relative to what we have to decide. Isn't that likely?
I don't believe it's likely, Your Honor. I believe that it is much more likely that they will focus on the questions that the Second Circuit asked them about the application of the adverse interest exception. And I'm kind of somewhat embarrassed to raise this, but there was a case cited in the appellant's briefs in which we were a party as well, and I was counsel of record.
We noted that. I noted that anyway.
And so the AHRQ decision came down last night. I got it about 11 o'clock
this,
at night.
This was the certified question to Pennsylvania from the Third Circuit?
It was the certified question from the Third Circuit to the Supreme Court of Pennsylvania.
Right.
And in that decision, apropos of whether the New York Court of Appeals is likely to go beyond the scope, one of the issues was whether impari delicto would be a defense to aiding and abetting. And there was an issue in the case as to whether Pennsylvania recognizes aiding and abetting at all. And what the court did in a footnote was to say, well, you didn't ask us to answer that question, so we're not going to resolve it for you. We're just saying if it does apply, then the following is the result, if there is such a cause of action. But it struck me that at least the Pennsylvania Supreme Court didn't think it was worthwhile going beyond the questions the Third Circuit had actually put to it. And I believe the New York Court of Appeals is more likely than not to take the same approach in REFCO.
And since there was no question that explicitly asked whether the pari delicto defense applied at all, then your point is that the New York Court of Appeals will likely answer in a way that presupposes that the doctrine does apply.
Which is precisely what the Pennsylvania Court of Appeals did with respect to aiding and abetting in the AHRQ decision. By the way, we will, with my apologies, we will mail that in. I got it, printed it out this morning before I left the house and read it on the train. I do have a copy if the court would like it. Otherwise, I will.
Mailing it's fine.
Okay. But
mail it to your opposing counsel.
Absolutely. The one last thing on the AHRQ decision. The AHRQ decision at bottom line says that for claims like these, under Pennsylvania law at least, impari delicto is a defense to an outside auditor for the kinds of negligence claims that have been brought here. And I want to just take a minute on what Mr. Grant said about it has to be the same wrong. There are any number of cases in which the corporate insiders are charged with deliberate intentional fraud, and the outside auditor is said to simply have failed either contractually or under the professional standards to have met his or her obligation to detect the fraud. Impari delicto under New York law, there isn't a case that says it doesn't apply. And there are many, many cases that says it does. And that is true in the REFCO decision itself. They're asking about the adverse interest exception. You don't need to come to the exception if you believe that there is a reason that the doctrine just doesn't have any application. And I want to make it clear that not only was adverse interest, it was argued below and not preserved on this appeal, but this participants criminis argument was never, ever raised with Vice Chancellor Strine. It simply wasn't. The appellant below argued strenuously that Delaware and not New York law applied and made almost no arguments below about New York law, leastwise this peculiar argument that they've made here. It is perfectly clear that different kinds of wrongs are capable of being the basis of an impari delicto defense. The Trainer case, the wrongs are different. One side violates the insurance code. The other side makes an intentional misrepresentation about his health. The original Smith v. Bromley case, the case in 1760 that starts impari delicto on its way, the wrongs were different. The wrongs are almost always different in kind. But in this case, what the plaintiff said, the appellant has said, is that there was a scheme, an overall scheme on the part of AIG insiders to misstate the financial condition of the company for a variety of reasons for which they benefited, to pay less taxes, to not pay workman's comp by misclassifying various things, and to use the inflated stock to acquire other insurance companies at what amounts to a discount. Part of that scheme involved fooling the outside auditors. And Mr. Grant said today, and he said in his briefs, that no one caused PwC to fail in detecting this in the audit. That's not what the complaint says. The complaint incorporates AIG's 2005 Form 10-K in its entirety. And that Form 10-K is replete with admissions by AIG, who is, after all, the real plaintiff here, that the insiders working on its behalf went out of their way to failed to disclose and to disguise from the internal auditors and the external auditors what they were actually doing.
Well, I think in another part of Mr. Grant's brief, he makes the argument that they should not have been able to succeed, that part of the professional negligence was not discovering this Machiavellian plot.
Yes, that's right, and it was a Machiavellian plot laid out in great detail, but in the complaint itself, the allegations are that the deals, some of the deals were papered in a way that was intended to deceive the outside auditors. And yes, we didn't find it, and we did not make a 12B6 motion to say that no claim for negligence was stated here, because this defense is in pari delicto. It assumes that there's fault on both sides of some sort. We're not standing here before you saying that this was a perfect audit. What we're saying is that in pari delicto, and what Vice Chancellor Strine ultimately, after a very long argument, agreed with us on, under New York law, in pari delicto prevents a company from coming forward and suing its outside auditor when the company has been engaged in intentional fraud. And, you know, I have a very simple way of looking at this. What we're accused of doing is not telling AIG what it already knew it was doing. We're left to hold the bag because the fraud was uncovered and they suffered damage as a result. But for all the years that they were doing this, they were reaping enormous benefits to the tune of hundreds of millions of dollars.
Well, but we come back to the question. I understand your argument, and Mr. Grant's argument is in pari delicto doesn't apply to acts of negligence. And your response is that's clear under all the cases you've cited, but the glaring omission is we don't have a definitive opinion from the Court of Appeals in New York. So to rule in your favor and to affirm the Court of Chancery, whatever we do, like the Court of Chancery, is going to be based on a prediction, isn't it?
That's exactly right, Your Honor, a prediction of what the court. But let me take a minute as a New York lawyer and just say that it is not unusual. The jurisdiction of the Court of Appeals is discretionary. You don't have many cases where there is a right to take your appeal to the Court of Appeals. And therefore, it is not unusual that the cases that we cite as the final authority or the highest authority of New York law are appellate division cases. Some cases they're Supreme Court cases, the trial level. But rarely, unless there's some dispute between the appellate divisions, a lot of these cases just don't get to the Court of Appeals.
We envy those courts that get to pick their cases.
Yeah,
we're not one of them.
I'm certain that you do. But it is also the case that these claims have started being brought in the last few years. But in the past, no one would bring these claims because everyone understood that if you want to stand in the company's shoes, whether you're a derivative plaintiff, whether you're a trustee, that you were subject to whatever defenses the company could have been subject to if it had brought the case in its own name. And effectively what Mr. Grant is saying to you is he's not asking you to resolve some unsettled question of New York law. He's asking you to give him a chance to go to the Court of Appeals and to argue that shouldn't be the rule, that I, as a derivative plaintiff, ought to be in a better position than the company whose shoes I'm standing in, particularly vis-a-vis this defense. And that is one of the reasons why there aren't a lot of cases on this issue on all fours, because people don't bring them. Because you have to understand that if the company defrauded everyone, including its auditors, and that's what his complaint says, that it's very hard then to stand there and say that the auditors should be the ones left holding the bag, or any other outside professional for that matter. I don't believe, you know, there's a tendency to focus this on auditors. I don't believe that that's the right focus. This could have easily been a law firm on a variety of things. It could have been other kinds of professionals. If the insiders are committing a fraud and they're intentionally deceiving their outside advisors, how is it equitable in any sense of the word for the company then, after they get caught, to turn around and say, you should have caught me, you should have told me to stop doing what I already knew I was doing, or you should have warned me that I was committing fraud? There's no argument here that they weren't committing intentional fraud.
That would be a perfectly persuasive argument if there were no independent directors or innocent, high-level executives involved. But I understand that there were at least some independent, innocent directors, and those are the people, it's the existence of those people that makes it hard for your metaphor to carry through with, on all fours with this case.
With all due respect, Your Honor, I think I understand why, on some level, that makes the metaphor difficult. But there are no courts that we're aware of who have embraced this innocent decision maker or insider
And in fact, in the case that you're going to hear following this, that issue was actually raised in a much more complete manner. And Vice Chancellor Strine made the point in his decision in that particular set of cases that if you were to do that, if you were to hold that a corporation can point to one or two or more innocent insiders and then avoid imputation of the wrongful conduct of its employees, of its officers and other managers, that you would be placing a corporation in a better position than a natural person would be in, because a natural person could not disclaim. And I also believe that there's a very complete discussion of this by Judge Boudin of the First Circuit in the Baena case, in which he says it can't be the case that a company engages in price fixing and the directors say, if only I had known, I would have stopped it and yet not be liable for the price fixing. That's not how the rules of agency work. And what you're being asked to do is both to change fundamentally or to have ask the New York Court of Appeals to fundamentally change the nature of a derivative action as well as the underlying rules of agency. With respect to third parties, unless the agent is acting adversely to its principal's interest, the principal is charged with the knowledge and conduct of the agent. That's Hornbook law that was there when I started law school. It's been there a long time before that. And that is the rule that you're being asked to disregard, to say in these circumstances, let's put the company in a derivative case in a better position than it would have been had it brought the claim itself. And I don't see that there's any authority in New York for that. I don't believe there's authority in Delaware for that proposition. I think the B&O Railroad case makes perfectly clear that when you stand in the shoes of another party, you take the claims, and they are no better or worse than the claims that the other party had. And if there are defenses that could have been raised against that party, you're subject to the same defenses. And I don't believe there's any question under New York law that in pari delicto is a defense. And I go back to the Trainer case. The John Hancock was not alleged to have known that the agent was doing what he or she was doing. It's not clear from the decision. In fact, the decision goes out of its way to say that the agent acted in a way to make it more difficult for Hancock to actually figure out what was going on. So, for example, before he put in the old policies to redeem them for cash, he waited for the underwriting to approve the new policy he was putting in place. He didn't ask for a credit check. He pretended that the insured was simply a re-up and not a new policy. And that was part of the violation of the insurance regulations. But nonetheless, the Court of Appeals said that Hancock was responsible for the conduct and knowledge of the agent, and that in pari delicto therefore barred the claim, because Hancock was in pari delicto with the insured who had misrepresented his health. So I don't believe, I mean, if you're looking for the Blue Buick case that's on all fours, I'll be honest with you, there isn't one in New York in the Court of Appeals. But the Court of Appeals has been pretty consistent about in pari delicto and about the agency rules of imputation. The light has gone off.
Well, you still have 3 minutes.
I'm happy to continue on. I do not believe, I want to go back to this participants criminis. The argument wasn't made below. Exactly the opposite argument was made. There was no citation to New York law for the proposition. What we were both responding to was Vice Chancellor Strine saying to us, how can I hold that the co-conspirators, the third-party co-conspirators, Jen Ray, for example, how can I hold that they can raise in pari delicto and at the same time hold that the outside auditor, who was only accused of being negligent and who, in fact, was to some extent a victim of the same fraud, can't invoke that? And my answer to him was, you can't do that. That makes no sense logically, that the more innocent person is stripped of the defense and the more guilty you are, you're allowed to invoke it. The appellant's answer below was neither of them can invoke the defense. There wasn't an argument. The criminis argument that's being made here is that you had to have been criminally culpable with the other side in order to raise in pari delicto. There is no New York case that says that. There is no New York decision that says it's a two-pronged test, in pari delicto plus participation in some criminal act. That's simply not what the Talmadge case says. The Talmadge case is a pretty simple case, where someone says, I bought these bonds, and now I have to pay back for them, but actually what I did with the bonds was ultra-virus, so you can't recover the value of the bonds that you sold to me. And the court ultimately says, no in pari delicto has never been held to bar someone from bringing a claim against someone whose defense is, well, I acted ultra-virus, and therefore the contract was illegal from the start. So this grafting on of another requirement simply doesn't exist at New York law. There's no question, and last thing on the questions, none of the questions that are asked, even the questions presented, or at page 33 of the opening brief, have anything whatsoever to do with the adverse interest exception, because it's simply not here on appeal. Okay, what the questions were at page 33 was, given the convergence of imputation and impari delicto, shouldn't derivative shareholders be in a better position? Shouldn't they be immune from the invocation of the defense? And the second question was the innocent insider exception, if there were innocent insiders. None of that had to do with anything that has been certified to the Court of Appeals yet, and none of it is unclear under New York law. We cited a number of lower New York cases, both state and federal, that say New York has never adopted this innocent insider exception. It would be a dramatic change in the way 503 of the restatement of agency worked, which is what operates in New York. And this is not the circumstance for it. Remember, going back to sort of where I started, this is a case in which the complaint, not the answer and not a motion, the complaint said that the auditors were intentionally misled by the insiders.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Your Honor, let me take on the Trainer case that Mr. Rafferty seems to hang his hat on now. First of all, John Hancock doesn't do audits. So we're not talking about auditors, despite the fact he says it's right on point. And the other key thing in Trainer is the two parties colluded. It specifically says in there that the two parties colluded. And that's when you may well have it. The insurance agent and the husband had formulated and executed a plan to conceal the fact of the new policy prior to its replacement. So that's what we were talking about there. He then says that, you know, no New York court has ever decided something like this. Well, in response to Justice Berger's question, here is the First Department. So the Appellate Division, First Department, same level that he's talking about, that he says there's, you know, no dispute among them. In the Morgado Family Partners versus, of all people, PricewaterhouseCoopers. And there, the court says, however, it is unsettled that impari delicto can ever apply against an innocent non-bankruptcy trustee. And even if it could, it is not clear at this pre-answer, pre-discovery stage of the litigation, and we're not pre-answer, but we are pre-discovery in this litigation, would it apply to the trustee's claims? That was in 2005. Then in 2007, at the trial level court, which is the New York State Supreme Court, in Williamson versus PricewaterhouseCoopers, they seem to blow a lot of these audits, the court basically says, thus, it is only through derivative claims that PwC can be liable. If I were to apply impari delicto, PwC, an alleged wrongdoer, would enjoy complete protection while the innocent investors might fail to receive redress. And the court relies a lot on Vice Chancellor Strine's Treadway case and says, you know, it didn't operate that way in Delaware, and it shouldn't in New York. And why shouldn't it? Because what is an auditor for? They say, well, you can't hold the auditors responsible if the company misstates its financial records. Well, then why do we have audits? Let's just get rid of them. Let's save companies all the time, all the money. Let's get rid of audits. Because you need an auditor to check and make sure that the company's financials are correct. If the company is never going to get them wrong, then we don't need an auditor. And if the auditor can approach this where they never can be held responsible, no matter how negligent they are, or for that matter, no matter how willful they are. Because under Mr. Rafferty's theory, that if someone deliberately said, you know what, I am going to misstate these financial records. I'm going to make sure I know that the CFO is monkeying with it, and I am going to deliberately help him do that. Then what happens when they catch him and say, well, how did you do this audit that we paid you, I believe, $210 million over the span of this time, $210 million to audit? And then they say, huh, can't hold us responsible. How can that possibly be the law? How can that possibly be public policy in Delaware or New York to say that you just give them a free pass? Because if this is true, you can never, ever, ever hold an auditor negligent. Because in the first instance, it's the company's books and records. They have to put it together. If they put it together wrong, then he's saying auditors are off the hook.
Mr. Grant, I may not have this right, but Mr. Rafferty argues that, you know, there are a number of exceptions to the doctrine that is the pari delicto doctrine, that were never raised in the Court of Chancery. And I think, but I'm not sure, that he also is contending that the argument that you're making now, that is you have to have collusion as a predicate for the application of pari delicto, that argument also was not raised. Is that correct?
No, I don't think that's true. And I think in our brief, we go through and we actually detail, I think, the dialogue that went through. Actually, on page 3 and page 4, where I think I said...
Page 3 and 4 of what?
I'm sorry, our answer, our reply brief, because they raised that. And we talked about, the court and I got into a discussion, and that, you know, I specifically say, and quoting myself, which is probably not a real good thing to do, but on page 3 of the brief we say, I think that really, when you look at it, at least with PwC, the policy reasons for eliminating professional negligence and breach of contract just at the time you need it the most would be such, I don't know how you could get there, but could find that you get exculpated from it. And then I go on to discuss this whole idea of negligence. So, I mean, you know, what we discussed was whether there should be imputation at all. And, you know, I will concede that it certainly wasn't set up in little boxes that says, you know, when we said, well, you shouldn't impute it, and this is why, and we talked about the innocent insider exception, and we talked about, and that was talked about as part of the argument, why the court ruled that with regard to Hank Greenberg and Smith and some of the others, that you wouldn't impute the corporation's knowledge. So we got into that whole discussion about imputation and innocent insider and when it's done, and we were talking more about imputation. And I would add that the Second Circuit, in the Refco case, says we conclude that the issues concerning imputation and the adverse interest exception, because they really go together. I mean, you know, we say, well, it shouldn't be imputed for these reasons, and they say, yes, it should be imputed, and then as well, there's an exception. Do I need an exception, or does it not imputed? I think it's part of the same discussion, and certainly in the court's opinion, he discusses this issue. So it wasn't like he didn't have an opportunity to think about these things. They were raised sufficiently so that he thought about it and he wrote about it. And I think that's the purpose of the rule, is not a game, aha, you didn't say these words in the court below. It's so that the trial court can have first shot at addressing the issue. And clearly this court, I mean, the proof is in the pudding, that the trial court here addressed these issues. I think he got them wrong, but I think he addressed those issues. I guess I would end by saying that maybe Mr. Rafferty does agree with me, and it's nice to end on a point that we agree upon. He says that there are, you know, questions that are not in front of the Court of Appeals in New York in REFCO, and they really should be answered because he's afraid that they may answer limited questions and not get to our questions. And so maybe we can agree that this court ought to send our questions to the Court of Appeals, including the very simple one, should in pari delicto apply to a situation with a company and its outside auditor with regard to malpractice? And I'd have no problem setting that question up because I think they'll answer it in our favor. And if they don't, it'll certainly make the case easier. So maybe Mr. Rafferty and I can agree with that and collectively ask the court to do so. If you don't have any other questions, I'm done.
Thank you. Thank you both. The court will take this matter under advisement and will take a brief recess.